Garrick has to wear glasses, Tara said, and poured fresh coffee into Shaz's cup. Glasses? He looked up from his newspaper. What do you mean, glasses? I mean eyeglasses, spectacles. I took him to the optician while you were away. He's short-sighted. But nobody in our family has ever worn glasses. Shaza looked down the breakfast table at his son, and Garrick lowered his head guiltily. Until that moment, he had not realized that he had disgraced the entire family. He had believed the humiliation of spectacles was his alone. Glasses? Shaza's scorn was undisguised. While you were having him fitted with glasses, you might as well get them to fit a cork in the end of his whistle to stop him wetting his bed also. Sean let out a guffaw and dug an elbow into his brother's ribs, and Garrick was stung into self-defence. "Gee, Dad, I haven't wet my bed since last Easter," he declared furiously, red-faced with embarrassment and close to tears of humiliation. Sean made circles with his thumbs and forefingers and peered through them at his brother. "We'll have to call you Owly Wet Sheets," he suggested. And as usual, Michael came to his brother's defence. "Owls are wise," he pointed out reasonably. "That's why Gary came top of his class this term. Where did you come in yours, Sean?" And Sean glared at him wordlessly. Michael always had a mild but stinging retort. "All right, gentlemen," Shaza returned to his newspaper. "No bloodshed at the breakfast table, please." Isabella had been out of the limelight for long enough. Her father had given far too much of his attention to her brothers, and she hadn't yet received her dues. Her father had arrived home late the previous evening, long after she was in bed, and the traditional ceremony of homecoming had not been fully enacted. Certainly he had kissed and pampered her and told her how beautiful she was, but one vital aspect had been neglected, and though she knew it was bad manners to ask, she had contained herself long enough.
"Didn't you even bring me a present?"
she piped. And Shaza lowered his newspaper again. "A present? Now what on earth is a present?"
"Don't be a silly billy, Daddy. You know what it is."
"Bella, you know you mustn't beg for presents," Tara chided.
"If I don't tell him, Daddy might just forget,"
Isabella pointed out reasonably, and made her special angel face at Shaza. "My goodness gracious me," Shaza snapped his fingers. "I did almost forget." And Isabella hopped her lace-clad bottom up and down on her high stool with excitement.
You did bring me one!"
"Finish your porridge first," Tara insisted. And Isabella's spoon clanked industriously on china as she devoured the last of it and scraped the plate clean. They all trooped through from the breakfast room to Shaza's study.
"I'm the littlest one. I get my present first,"
Isabella made up the rules of life as she went along. "All right, littlest one, step to the front of the line, please." Her face a masterpiece of concentration, Isabella stripped away the wrappings from her gift.
"A doll!"
she squeaked, and showered kisses upon its bland china face.
"Her name is Oleander, and I love her already."
Isabella was the owner of what was probably one of the world's definitive collections of dolls, but all editions were rapturously received. When Sean and Gary were handed their long packages, they went still with awe. They knew what they were. They had both of them pleaded long and eloquently for this moment, and now that it had arrived, they were reluctant to touch their gifts in case they disappeared in a puff of smoke. Michael hid his disappointment bravely. He had hoped for a book. So secretly, he empathized with his mother when she cried with exasperation,
"Oh, Shaza, you haven't given them guns."
All three rifles were identical. They were Winchester repeaters in .22 caliber, light enough for the boys to handle. "This is the best present anybody ever gave me." Sean lifted his weapon out of the cardboard box and stroked the walnut stock lovingly.
"Me too."
Garrick still couldn't bring himself to touch his. He knelt over the open package in the middle of the study floor, staring raptly at the weapon it contained.
"It's super, Dad," said Michael,
holding his rifle awkwardly, and his smile was unconvincing.
"Oh, don't use that word, Mickey," Tara snapped.
"It's so American and vulgar." But she was angry with Shaza, not Michael.
"Look,"
Gary touched his rifle for the first time. My name. It's got my name on it. He stroked the engraving on the barrel with his fingertip, then looked up at his father with myopic adoration. I wish you'd brought them anything but guns, Tara burst out. I asked you not to, Shaza. I hate them. Well, my dear, they must have rifles if they're coming on a hunting safari with me.
A safari?
Sean shouted gleefully. When? It's time you learned about the bush and the animals, Shaza put his arm around Sean's shoulders. You can't live in Africa without knowing the difference between a scaly anteater and a chakma baboon. Gary snatched up his new rifle and went to stand as close to his father's side as he could, so that Shaza could also put his other arm around his shoulders, if he wanted to. However, Shaza was talking to Sean. We'll go up to southwest in the June holes, take a couple of trucks from the Hani mine, and drive through the desert until we reach the Okavango swamps. Shaza, I don't know how you can teach your own children to kill those beautiful animals. I really don't understand it, Tara said bitterly. Hunting is a man's thing, Shaza agreed. You don't have to understand. You don't even have to watch. Can I come, Dad? Gary asked diffidently, and Shaza glanced at him. You'll have to polish up your new specs so you can see what you're shooting at. Then he relented. Of course you're coming, Gary. And then he looked across at Michael, standing beside his mother. What about you, Mickey? Are you interested? Michael glanced apologetically at his mother before he replied softly. Gee, thanks, Dad. It would be fun. Your enthusiasm is touching, Shaza grunted. And then, very well, gentlemen, all the rifles locked in the gun room, please. Nobody touches them again without my permission and my supervision. We'll have our first shooting practice this evening when I get back home. Shaza made a point of getting back to Veltefrieden with 2 hours of daylight in hand, and he took the boys down to the range he had built, over which to sight in his own hunting rifles. It was beyond the vineyards, and far enough from the stables not to disturb the horses or any of the other livestock. Sean, with the coordination of a born athlete, was a natural shot. The light rifle seemed immediately an extension of his body, and within minutes he had mastered the art of controlling his breathing and letting the shot squeeze away without effort. Michael was nearly as good, but his interest wasn't really in it, and he lost concentration quickly. Gary tried so hard that he was trembling, and his face was screwed up with effort. The horn-rimmed spectacles which Tara had fetched from the optician that morning kept sliding down his nose and misting over as he aimed, and it took 10 shots for him finally to get one on the target. You don't have to pull the trigger so hard, Gary, Shaza told him with resignation. It won't make the bullet go any further or any faster, I assure you. It was almost dark when the four of them got back to the house, and Shaza led them down to the gun room and showed them how to clean their weapons before locking them away. Sean and Mickey are ready to have a crack at the pigeons, Shaza announced, as they trooped upstairs to change for dinner. Gary, you'll need a little more practice. A pigeon is more likely to die of old age than one of your bullets. Sean shouted with laughter.
Kill them with old age, Gary!
Michael did not join in. He was imagining one of the lovely blue and pink rock pigeons that nested on the ledge outside his bedroom window, dying in a drift of loose feathers, splattering ruby drops as it fluttered to earth. It made him feel physically sick, but he knew his father expected it of him. That evening, as usual, the children came one at a time to say good night to Shaza as he was tying his black bow tie. Isabella was first.
I'm not going to sleep a wink until you come home tonight, Daddy, she warned him. I'm just going to lie all by myself in the dark.
Sean came next. You're the best dad in the world, he said as they shook hands. Kissing was for sissies. Will you let me have that in writing? Shaza asked solemnly. It was Michael who was always the most difficult to answer.
Dad, do animals and birds hurt a lot when you shoot them?
Not if you learn to shoot straight, Shaza assured him. But Mickey, you have too much imagination. You can't go through life worrying about animals and other people all the time.
Why not, Dad? Michael asked softly.
and Shaza glanced at his wristwatch to cover his exasperation. We have to be at Kelvin Grove by 8. Do you mind if we go into that some other time, Mickey? Garrick came last. He stood shyly in the doorway of Shaza's dressing room, but his voice shook with determination as he announced, I'm going to learn to be a crack shot like Sean. You'll be proud of me one day, Dad, I promise you. Garrick left his parents' wing and crossed to the nursery. Nanny stopped him at Isabella's door. She's asleep already, Master Gary. In Michael's room they discussed the promised safari, but Mickey's attention kept wandering back to the book in his hands, and after a few minutes, Gary left him to it. He looked into Sean's room cautiously, ready to take flight if his elder brother showed any signs of becoming playful. One of Sean's favourite expressions of fraternal affection was known as a chestnut and consisted of a painful knuckling of Gary's prominent ribcage. However, this evening Sean was hanging backwards over his bed, heels propped on the wall, and the back of his head almost touching the floor, a Superman comic book held at arm's length above his face. Good night, Sean, Gary said. Shazam, said Sean, without lowering the comic book. Garrick retreated thankfully to his own room and locked the door. Then he went to stand before the mirror and regard the reflection of his new horn-rimmed spectacles. I hate them, he whispered bitterly. And when he removed them, they left red indentations on the bridge of his nose. He went down on his knees, removed the skirting board under the built-in wardrobe, and reached into the secret recess beyond. Nobody, not even Sean, had discovered this hiding place. Carefully, he withdrew the precious package. It had cost him 8 weeks of his accumulated pocket money, but was worth every penny. It had arrived in a plain wrapper with a personal letter from Mr. Charles Atlas himself. Dear Garrick, the letter had begun, and Gary had been overcome with the great man's condescension. He laid out the course on his bed and stripped to his pajama pants as he revised the lessons. Dynamic tension, he whispered aloud, and he took up his stance before the mirror. As he began the sequence of exercises, he kept time with the soft chant of, More and more in every way, I'm getting better every day. When he finished, he was sweating heavily, but he made an arm and studied it minutely. They are bigger. He tried to put aside his doubts as he poked the little walnut of muscle that popped out of his straining biceps. They really are. He stowed the course back in its hidey-hole and replaced the skirting board. Then he took his raincoat from the wardrobe and spread it on the bare boards. Garrick had read with admiration how Frederick Saluce, the famous African hunter, had toughened himself as a boy by sleeping uncovered on the floor in winter. He switched out the light and settled down on the raincoat. It was going to be a long, uncomfortable night, he knew from experience. The floorboards were like iron, but the raincoat would prevent Sean detecting any nocturnal spillage when he made his morning inspection, and Garrick was certain that his asthma had improved since he had stopped sleeping on a soft mattress with a warm eiderdown over him. I'm getting better every day, he whispered, closing his eyes tightly and willing himself to ignore the cold and the hardness of the floor. And then one day Dad will be proud of me, just like he is of Sean. I thought your speech this evening was very good, even for you, Tara told him, and Shaza glanced at her with surprise. She had not paid him a compliment for a long time now. Thank you, my dear. I sometimes forget what a gifted person you are, she went on. It's just that you make it seem so easy and natural. He was so moved that he might have reached across to caress her, but she was leaning away from him, and the hooper coachwork of the rolls was too wide for him to reach her. I must say you look absolutely stunning this evening, he compromised with a matching compliment. But as he had expected, she dismissed it with a grimace. Are you really going to take the boys on safari? My dear, we have to let them make up their own minds about life. Sean will love it, but I'm not too sure about Mickey, Shaza replied, and she noticed that he hadn't mentioned Garrick. Well, if you are determined, then I'm going to take advantage of the boy's absence. I've been invited to join the archaeological dig at the Sundi Caves. But you're a novice. He was surprised. That's an important site. Why would they invite you? Because I offered to contribute £2,000 to the cost of the dig. That's why. I see. This is straight blackmail. He chuckled sardonically as he saw the reason for her flattery. All right, it's a deal. I'll give you a check tomorrow. How long will you be away? I'm not sure. But she thought, as long as I can be close to Moses Gama. The site at Sundi Caves was only an hour's drive from the house at Rivonia. She reached under the fur coat and touched her stomach. It would begin to show soon. She had to find excuses to keep away from the eyes of the family. Her father and Shaza would not notice. She was sure of that. But Santine de Thierry, Courtney Malcolmes, had eyes like a hawk. I presume that my mother has agreed to care for Isabella while you were away, Shaza was saying. And while she nodded, her heart was singing. Moses, I'm coming back to you. Both of us are coming back. To you, my darling. Whenever Moses Gama came to Drake's farm, it was like a king returning to his own realm after a successful crusade. Within minutes of his arrival, the word was flashed almost telepathically through the vast, sprawling black township, and a sense of expectancy hung over it, as palpable as the smoke from 10,000 cooking fires. Moses usually arrived with his half-brother, Hendrik Tabaka, in the butcher's delivery van. Hendrik owned a chain of a dozen butcher shops in the black townships along the Witwatersrand, so the sign writing on the side of the van was authentic. In sky blue and crimson it declared, Fuse Muchle, butchery, best meat at best prices. From the vernacular, Fuse Muchle, translated as eat well, and the van provided a perfect cover for Hendrik Tabaka wherever he went. Whether he was genuinely delivering slaughtered carcasses to his butcheries, or goods to his general dealer stores, or was engaged in less conventional business, the distribution of illicitly brewed liquor, the notorious Skokian or township dynamite, or ferrying his girls to their places of business nearer the compounds that housed the thousands of black contract workers of the gold mines, so that they could briefly assist them in relieving their monastic existence, or whether he was on the business of the African Mine Workers Union, that close-knit and powerful brotherhood whose existence the white government refused to acknowledge, the blue and red van was the perfect vehicle. When he was at the wheel, Hendrik wore a peaked driver's cap and a khaki tunic with cheap brass buttons. He drove sedately and with meticulous attention to all the rules of the road, so that in 20 years he had never been stopped by the police. When he drove the van into Drake's farm, with Moses Gama sitting in the passenger seat beside him, they were entering their own stronghold. This was where they had established themselves when together they had arrived from the wastelands of the Kalahari 20 years before. Although they were sons of the same father, they had been different in almost every way. Moses had been young and tall and marvellously handsome, while Hendrik was years older, a great bull of a man with a bald, scarred head and gapped and broken teeth. Moses was clever and quick, self-educated to a high standard, charismatic and a leader of men, while Hendrik was the faithful lieutenant, accepting his younger brother's authority and carrying out his orders swiftly and ruthlessly. Though Moses Gama had conceived the idea of building up a business empire, it was Hendrik who had made the dream a reality. Once he was shown what to do, Hendrik Tabaka was as much a bulldog in tenacity as he was in appearance. For Hendrik, what they had built between them, the business enterprises, both illicit and legitimate, the trade union and its private army of enforcers, known and dreaded throughout the compounds where the mine workers lived, and through the black townships as the buffaloes, all these were an end in themselves. But for Moses Gama, it was different. What they had achieved thus far was only the first stage on his quest for something so much greater that although he had explained it many times to Hendrik, his brother could not truly grasp the enormity of Moses Gama's vision. In the 20 years since they had arrived there, Drake's farm had changed entirely. In those early days, it had been a small squatter's encampment, hanging like a parasite tick on the body of the huge complex of gold mines that made up the central Witwatersrand. It had been a collection of squalid hovels, built of scrap lumber and wattle poles and old iron sheets, flattened paraffin cans and tar paper on the bleak open felt. A place of open drains and cesspools, lacking reticulated water or electricity, without schools or clinics or police protection. Not even recognised as human habitation by the white city fathers in Johannesburg's town hall. It was only after the war that the Transvaal Divisional Council had decided to recognise reality and to expropriate the land from the absentee landowners. They had declared the entire 3,000 acres an official township set aside for black occupation under the Group Areas Act. They had retained the original name, Drake's Farm, for its picturesque connotations to old Johannesburg, unlike the more mundane origin of the nearby Soweto, which was merely an acronym for southwestern townships. Soweto already housed over 500,000 blacks, while Drake's Farm was home to less than half that number. The authorities had fenced off the new township and covered the greater part of it with monotonous lines of small three-roomed cottages, each identical except for the number stenciled on the cement brick front wall. Crowded close together and separated by narrow lanes with dusty, untarred surfaces, the flat roofs in galvanised corrugated iron shone like 10,000 mirrors in the brilliant high-felt sunlight.